South Texas Oral History and Folklore Collection. This interview shall be called the Harry Unken Memoirs. Mr. Unken lives at 1305 Stadium Road in Alice, Texas, with his wife, Lydia Kane Unken. He is 61 years old and has lived in the Orange Grove, Alice area since he was 1 year old. Mr. Unken is a retired farmer and has seen this area change from that of a pioneer frontier to a highly civilized area. Mr. Unken attends Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Alice and is always willing to help with activities at church, especially those requiring a skilled hand at carpentry. He is 6 feet 2 inches tall with wavy gray hair. Earliest remembrances begin when he was about 6 years old. This conversation was recorded on November 21, 1973, by Mrs. Molly Tall at Mr. Unken's home.
It might be interesting to know just how I came to South Texas and then living and live in this area the entire 60 years of my life. I was born on October the 10th, 1912, in DeWitt County, Texas. My father, then a young married man, began to look for greater things in life. He had heard of a place in South Texas that was being developed into a great farming area. So he came south, bought a farm, built a home. Then in the fall of 1913, moved his family to what is now known as Orange Grove, Texas, in the northern part of Jim Wells County. I, being only a year old at the time, was too young to know, and therefore I was told this by my parents. Some years earlier, a few pioneer families had settled here, had cleared away brush, and put this land in cultivation. In my memory, if my memory serves me correctly, Mr. and Mrs. Max Schubert, parents of Dr. J.A. Schubert, who has been a dentist here in Alice for some years. They cleaned out some of the first land here. Mr. Schubert had heard that the climate here was ideal for growing fruit trees. So he set out about 5 acres of young orange trees. In a very short time, he had a beautiful orchard growing. As more and more people migrated into the area and saw these bearing orange trees, they named the small town after what they saw. The name, Orange Grove. In the next few years, this became a thriving little community. The reason for this little community to spring up here was because of the railroad, which went from San Antonio to the valley, went right through this part of the country. Due to lack of transportation, and the only way these people could move in here was by train. When they got ready to move, they would place all their belongings in boxcars, including their livestock. as more and more people moved into the area, more land was put in cultivation. They plowed their land with small plows, drawn by either horses or mules. The most important crops grown was cotton, corn, and hay crops. They had to produce an abundance of corn and hay to feed their livestock. Since cotton was their main crop, it provided only a once-a-year income. So naturally, the farmer had to find some other means of supplementing his income. So he went to dairy cows for milk, and of course poultry for meat and eggs. Many farmers had to depend upon the banks for loans. He was a dependable man. The merchants would set him up with a yearly charge account. This then he would pay at harvest time. A great many farmers had yearly charge accounts in town. I can recall of one particular merchant who had quite a few charge accounts in his store. And one day, the customer came in and bought a saddle. And of course, being quite busy in his store, he failed to charge the saddle to this particular man. So he really didn't know just who had bought this saddle. So came the time to send out bills. He decided to bill every one of his customers with a saddle. In that way, he would be sure to get his money. And he felt that those that had not bought the saddle, they would come in and tell him about it, and then, of course, he would deduct that off of their bill. Soon after about 30 days, and he had received his money from his different customers, he checked back, and he found that he had received payment for 3 saddles when he had just actually sold 1.
I'd say you made a profit on that, wouldn't you? Oh, that's a good story.
The people that lived out in the country might come to town once a week to buy their things they needed. There was a post office in this little town. The mail came in once a day by train. There was a passenger train, and it had a mail car attached to it. There were mail trays that carried mail out to the people in the rural areas. Then in September 1919, when I was getting ready to after school, a hurricane struck this area in South Texas, doing millions of dollars of damage and bringing about a great loss in lives. The city of Corpus Christi was nearly completely demolished. This was a sad time for South Texas. It took quite some time for them to recuperate from this. The school built in those days were of a wood frame structure. A child had to be 7 years old before it was allowed to enter public school. Since September was the beginning of the school year, and I had birthday in October, naturally I was nearly 8 years old before I got to go to school. The teachers in our schools were strict and did not mind using the strap when it was needed. Whenever a student needed to be disciplined, he or she would be sent to the principal. The older boy students sometimes were punished in a queer way. We had wood furnaces in our schools to keep us warm in the winter. And since these furnaces were fired with cordwood, these boys that had misbehaved, they were forced to carry in so and so many sticks of wood for punishment. Sometimes there was quite a group of boys that had to be disciplined. And they, of course, when they started carrying in wood, they filled this school quite full of wood in that way.
Did you ever have to carry in very much wood?
Yes, I did. I still can recall when there was a group of Florida boys who were kicking the volleyball around. Of course, the principal caught us at it. And that was our punishment. And of course, there were about 20 boys in that group.
A lot of wood.
A lot of wood. And since we lived about 3 miles from school, transportation to and from school was a problem. All roads, even streets in the town, were of the plain earthen variety. During wet weather, these roads were almost impossible. As we went into the 1920s, the whole area became a beehive of activity. More and more land was cleared in the late 20s, out on the farm. Cotton had to become what we might call king. There was quite an abundance of it produced. In Jim Wells County alone at that time, about 9 cotton gins were in operation during the harvest season. And of course, all this was being picked by hand. This brought a lot of seasonal workers into the area. Then in the early 30s, the oil industry got started here in the county. Later, the northern part of Jim Wells County really went on a boom. There were a great deep number of wells brought in north of Orange Grove. But these wells, being of a shallow variety, did not last longer than perhaps on an average about 10 years. And right at the present time, are dry with the exception of a few. In the late 30s, something took place that you might say changed the entire way of life for the people living out in the rural areas in this part of the state. And of course, I am referring to rural electrification. It started in a small way then, and as the years went by, it was spread to where all rural areas in South Texas now have electric power. And also in the late 30s and early 40s, out on the farms, this area, several new crops came into being. Several farmers began to plant flax, and it seemed to do real good. Farmers increased their plantings each year until in the mid-40s, it was considered a profitable venture. About the same time, farmers began to plant large acreages of grain sorghum. In the next few years, increased acreage and yields brought about a surplus both in grain and cotton. Now I think we should talk a little about what actually occurred in this little town. In these days, in those days, every little town had a doctor. He, of course, made house calls any time of the day or night, just whenever he was needed. His office, most of the time, would be located in some back corner of a drugstore. Since there weren't but a very few hospitals in the area, he of course performed minor surgery right in his office. Speaking of minor surgery, I have to think back when I was around 6 years old. I was rounding up the horses early one morning, riding my favorite pony, I got too close behind the horse I was driving home to the lot. And that horse kicked at me and hit my leg, opening up a large gash on the upper part of my leg. My father took me to the city of Mathis, where there was a doctor who also was a surgeon. There in the back of the drugstore, in his office, with my father and another man holding me down, the doctor put 26 stitches in my leg without first giving me an anesthetic. After being laid up for about 7 months, I was back on my feet and ready to go again. And weddings, whenever there would be a wedding in the area, the people involved, plus their neighbors, prepared for days. No wedding without a big Taiwan dance. Neighbors would come and help build a big platform in the yard so they could dance. Music would be furnished by someone in the neighborhood who played the accordion. And sometimes the violin and the guitar. Yes, those were the days. Speaking, going back and speaking of the production of green and cotton, in the early 50s, our government was forced to put a farm program in effect whereby we were able to control the production of these farm commodities. And the government program has been in effect all these years. As I sit here and think back over the past, we must admit that agriculture and the oil industry has been a great asset to the South Texas area. This has made the area a great place to live in. And just imagine that is the reason. I just imagine that is the reason that I am still living here after being here for 60 years.
Mr. Ankin, you have given me just an excellent account of life as it was here in South Texas during those times. But I'd like to go back now to when you were younger and see if we can dig up some personal things that you might remember. And one thing I was thinking about, when you were talking about how the boys were punished at school, did the girls ever get in trouble? Were they so sweet back in those days?
No, they did get into some trouble. But of course, they weren't dealt with as harshly as the boys.
Did you all, were there one-room schoolhouses in those days and all grades were put in one room? Or?
Well, actually, there was one school built. It was quite a large building. But, you know, as the years went by, in the population increased and there was more and more children came to school, eventually they ran out of space. So there were several, I call them two-room buildings, added to this system away from the main building. And I can still recall when I was in the sixth grade, that was one of my rooms, you know, in the outlying mm-hmm. buildings. Now there's one thing that might be interesting. There has been a teacher that has been teaching here in the Ellis school system up until about 2 years ago. She was my teacher in the Orange Grove School when I was in the fifth grade.
What's her name? Do you recall her name?
Her name right at the present time is Sarah Manuel. And when she taught me there, she started off there as a single girl. Her name then was Sally McAnee. And she was there several years, and then she married a rancher out there by the name of George Reynolds. And of course, I don't know what happened, but she later on married this fellow Manuel. Mm-hmm. And all these years she's been teaching here in the Ellis school system up until, you probably know her, Sarah Manuel.
I think there was an article in the paper.
Yeah, at one time.
When she retired.
Yes. Right.
Mm-hmm. There was some sort of reception for her. When you got home from school in the afternoon, was it all work and chores, or did your kids have time to play?
Well, actually, we didn't have too much time to play. Our chores were waiting out on the farm for us, you know, as soon as we got home. And, of course, we were told by our parents not to hang around at school too long after classes were dismissed. However, as the years went by and when I got into high school, I did participate in sports. Being a small Class B school at the time, about the only athletics they had there was baseball and basketball. And, of course, we did have a good basketball team. And in those years, there was no such thing as a Class A, Class B, or Class 1A, or Class 2A, or Class 3A, 4A. These schools all participated. They played against each other in the county. In other words, it was a county-wide program. That's the only way they worked. So, being a small Class B school, we had quite a struggle when we came over here and played Ellis.
So, there wasn't anything such as football back then when you were in high school?
You know, when I was the first year that I was out of school, that's when they started football, and that was about, I would say, in the year 1929 or 1930. I'm not quite positive. That's when they started play football. Now, that is in a small Class B school. They did have, football over here in Ellis in these larger schools.
Do you have any personal remembrances of World War I, how it affected
some of your relatives or some of the people? That's going back pretty far. You were fairly young.
See, at that time, that was 1917, 1918. Okay. See, I was about 6 or 7 years old. 6 years, yes. Mm. Okay, actually, I don't have too many remembrances of that. But, like I say, it was in 1919.
Duncan, you mentioned the great hurricane of 1919, how it demolished the city of Corpus Christi. Was your family personally affected in Orange Grove in any way?
Yes, in a small way, I would say. We had quite a home out there on the farm, a two-story home. And with this hurricane, it was knocked off the blocks. It was leaning. It wasn't demolished, but it was leaning. And therefore, before we could come back in, it had to be reworked. And as I said, the time that the hurricane came in, we weren't at home. We were up in DeWitt County with my grandparents. My mother at the time was in the hospital up in Yorktown. And we were staying with my grandparents. Now the city of Corpus Christi, I think the damage that occurred there was mostly caused by water coming in from the bay. That's about all that I can recall.
I have heard someone say, I was talking to someone here now sometimes, that mentioned that the waters of the bay came in so far that a lot of livestock and animals were drowned out in the low-lying areas. Do you remember anyone talking about that at the time?
Right, that is right. Anyone who is familiar with the city of Corpus Christi will know when we talk about the Bluff area. It's a place where the elevation increases suddenly.
It's in the downtown area.
Right. And I was told that the water came into the city that far. And of course, the outlying areas were all underwater, and that was just a great loss of life, and not only in people, but also in livestock.
Well, let's go on to a little bit more happy topic. That's probably a sad thing to talk about. How about courtship and marriage in your youth, Mr. Duncan? What can you tell me about that that might be of some interest to present day people?
Well, all I can say, it wasn't then like it is now. We were very fortunate to have parents that had automobiles. But we, as young people at home, we didn't have automobiles of our own like these youngsters have this day and time. We either had to use our parents' automobiles or walk. And as far as what this younger generation did for pastime. I can still remember right in our small area. There was a dance there every Saturday night. And of course, that was quite well attended. And that's where most of the younger generation met, and that's where they had most of their pastime.
Did anything wild ever happen? Anybody get mad and have a shootout outside the dance hall, or were things pretty tame in those days?
That is right. They did have that, and generally, when they had these dances on weekends, there was usually always trouble. It was usually always a certain group of boys, you know, that caused those problems. And as far as I myself is concerned, since I, this wife of mine, I happened to meet her at one of these big wedding dances down here in this area. And since she's from farther up, of course, if we wanted to correspond, we had to do that by mail.
Where exactly did she live, Mr. Uncle?
She lived up in the, what they call the Hallettsville area.
And her name at that time was?
Lydia Kane. K-O-E-H-N.
How did you two manage to correspond?
Just mail, and through the mails, you might say. And of course, I made an effort to go up there once or twice a year. You know, once or twice a year, mind you. Went up to see her and spent the week there. And after we got married in 1935, we settled down in this area here. We had rented us a small farm, and we moved out on this farm, and I did my farming there for about, well, actually up until 43, 44, that was the World War II years, I believe, that's when that started. And actually, we saw some hard times on the farm. And about 44, I had an opportunity to go to work in what they call a recycling plant in the Aladunce area. And in that way, I tried to supplement my income just a little. So there were several other men from that area that went to work over there in that plant, and of course we found a carpool. One of us drove every, you know, one morning, one drove, and the next morning, of course, the other, and so on. And the most interesting thing about this is that our wages at that time was 40 cents an hour. We drove about 30 miles, worked 8 hours for 40 cents an hour. And being that the war was in progress at the time, World War II, out of that we were asked to buy a war bond a month, which we did, which we felt was our duty. And after working there about 2 years, I was finally promoted. I went to work as an operator helper in the plant. Of course, my wages were increased. And I thought I was really getting some top wages at $1.25 an hour.
Okay, I'd like to go back in time now to something that you had mentioned earlier. You mentioned that in the 1920s, people started coming into this area and settling it, and I thought maybe we could talk of it as sort of a frontier area. And I'd like to, if you could tell us what these people did. And you said they arrived by a train. What they did after they got here and lived in this area?
Well, being a frontier area, well, it definitely was. And as the before the people ever moved down, started to move down, they had been down and acquired some property, you know, a small farm of some kind. And after they started to move, they knew just exactly where they were going after they got down here. But it's quite interesting to see that all this happened in just a few years' time. I guess the people that were here had friends and relatives further up, and of course they corresponded, and they were told just what kind of an area this was down here, and that it looked like it would really and truly amount to something. Of course, there were more and more made an effort to, you know, come down.
When they got here, did they have land to clear? Was it brush country? They have to work
well, actually, at that time, there was brush on the land, but it wasn't too much. It was a kind of a, well, you might call it a prairie. They actually didn't have too much brush to remove before they put it in cultivation at that time.
What methods did these peoples that moved in the 20s use to plow? Were there still horses and mules being used, or what had the tractor come in?
Well, actually, there were still horses and mules being used. I can still recall when I was at home, and it was even up in the but it was during the Depression years, in 29 and 30. As far as we were concerned, we were still farming the horses and mules. And just when that tractor area came in, this I don't know just offhand, I can't recall. But it must have been around, I would say, the mid 30s.
Do you have any idea when the first tractor showed up, or who had it? Maybe was it an object of curiosity for the people in the area?
Well, I don't like to brag about this, but my father actually was the first man to have a tractor in that area, and it was the people that might be familiar with tractors. I would say that it was an old Fortson. They called it an old Fortson. It was not a row crop tractor. It was just a tractor that you could use to put land into cultivation, that could have a big disc plow, and that's what my father used it for.
What was your father's first name? I
don't
believe I heard that.
Emil Amiel.
A-M-I-E-L?
E-M-I-E-L. And he's still living today.
Oh, well, how old is he?
He's 86.
And does he still live in Orange Grove?
No, he's living back up there in DeWitt County.
DeWitt.
He's living on the old Ogden homestead. And the old homestead up there is now 60 years old. That's the home that we originally left back there in 1913.
To come to South Texas. Talking about the railroad as being these people's means of transportation that came into the area, Did your kids ever try to hitch a ride on the train, or was it, were you forbidden by your parents?
Well, actually, you know, we weren't, what shall I say, we weren't too well acquainted with the train. In other words, we didn't hang around in town too much. And when we did come to town and we saw a train come through, it was really something, you know, we wanted to see, mm-hmm. because we didn't see too much of that. So actually, as far as the train is concerned, we didn't have too much to do with the train. Now, going back to this moving part, you know, when the people up there, they were pretty well settled. Some of them, they had livestock of all kinds, and they had their horses and mules. And when they moved down into this area, all of that was moved in boxcars. There were small corrals built in these boxcars for these animals. And perhaps another one where they placed their furnishing, home furnishings in. And when these trains left up there, there was always a man moved with the train, you know, in the boxcars, especially with the animals, to take care of them as they were en route.
Mr. Runkin, you mentioned earlier that people would go into town from the rural areas about once a week to do their shopping. Can you describe what a store was like that time, where your mother shopped when you were young?
Well, it was just a small, they called it a general store. On one side, they had the groceries. Then on the opposite side, of course, was room for the dry goods. And generally, this merchant was also a cotton buyer. He had a small office in the back of the store where he bought cotton. And the reason he bought these cotton was because a lot of these farmers had yearly charge accounts with them. And when they came in with their cotton, he bought their cotton, and in that way he was sure to get his money for his goods. And whenever these people would come in and buy groceries or dry goods, and they had the cash money to pay for it, this merchant would or give them a large bag of candy. In this store, he had a large 55-gallon barrel, wood barrel, filled with candy. And out of this, he gave the customer a small bag of candy. And this was known as Pilon.
What was the, can you recall the name of the merchant that was the own store at that time?
This one merchant that I have in mind, his name was F.G. Schmidt. He was in business there all these years. However, he had passed away here a number of years ago. Then his son took over the business. And after his son passed away, his grandson took over the store. However, now here several years ago, this store was sold to some other individual. But It is still in operation today.
Is this store in Alice?
No, it's in Orangeville.
What's the name of the store?
Right at the present time, it's called the Logics of Red and White.
What was the first one?
Logic.
P-I-L-A-R.
Oh, okay.
Z-C-I. Now, wait a minute. Anyhow, it's something like
okay,
that.
Okay. Well, so this door then has been in operation right. continuously since that right. time when you were young. Something that we haven't talked about at all were the churches of the time and how they affected your social life and your Sunday school teachers. So what are your remembrances about those?
Well, actually, I don't remember too much until I would sort of say around 1918. However, my parents told me that the first church that came into being in this small community was started in the year 1915. And at the time, this was a small congregation there, but for some reason or the other, they had a little misunderstanding. And this divided that congregation. So some of these pulled away from this congregation and built a new church. And I hate to say it, but my parents were one of the couples that left the church here and started a new church. And my father helped build this new church. And we stayed there, I would say, about the year 1925 is when we came back to this original church. This original church was affiliated with the American Lutheran Church, just like we are here today. And in the year 1928 is when I was confirmed by the late Pastor H.F. Grimm.
What about special events, revivals, that sort of thing?
Well, actually, once a year, we had monthly fellowship meetings, but once a year, we had what we call the Mission Festival. It was an all-day affair. We had church in the morning, and then, of course, a noon meal was served with free will donations. And of course, this money went for mission work. It served the same purpose as what we call benevolence today. Now, I think what is quite interesting and where a big change has taken place as far as the women in the church are concerned. In those days, the ladies had what they called a ladies' aid. These ladies met once a month, and they usually would meet on Sunday afternoons in the different homes of the members. But it wouldn't be only the ladies that would go to this meeting. The whole family went, children and all.
and it was made social. In other words, they had their meeting and then it turned to a social event. And of course, a big meal was served there, lunch with free will donations. And it is surprising just how much money came into the church in this way.
Did you have Sunday school?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had Sunday school. In fact, it was after 1935 that I can recall, after we got married, my wife taught in the Sunday school there. And she taught there until it was in the year 52 when we left. We came to Ellis, moved to Ellis. And as far as Sunday school is concerned, I would say there is just too much difference then than what it is today. In other words, you know, taking classes and all into consideration, there just actually isn't too much difference.
Do you recall going yourself? Did you have a lot of memory work that you had to do from week to week, or Bible passages?
State that again.
When you were in Sunday school yourself, back when you were younger, did you have to do homework, like to memorize Bible passages and write papers or anything?
No, I don't think so. However, you know, as a small boy or as a small child in Sunday school, we did do a lot of memory work. We had to do a lot of memory work. And the first time that I had to do homework was when I started confirmation class. That's actually when I had to do my first, you know, work at home.
Were you in your early teens then?
Yes, I was about, I would say, 13 years old, yes.
That's not too much different than from present day practices.
No,
they start in about 13 years old.
No, it sure isn't.
Mr. Unkin, what was the method of law enforcement back when you were growing up?
Well, I would say that it was about the same then like it is now. In our small town, we had what we call a constable. And he would take care of all the different law violations and the like. Of course, he was affiliated with the county sheriff, which was located here in Ellis. One instance that I can recall is my father had a garage over there in this little town. And right behind this little garage was what we call the jail. It was a little wood frame building with bars in the door. And one day I happened to be over at my father's garage and I heard a man calling. And I began to look around to see where this sound was coming from. And after I walked around behind the garage, I saw a man looking through the bars in this jail. And I went over and I asked him what he wanted. And he told me, he says, you know, he says, I am sure thirsty. I need some water. He says, would you please get me a drink of water? So, the door being about 6 inches thick, and the bars being close together, I knew that I could not hand him a glass of water through the bars. So, of course, just being a small boy, I struck out for the drugstore. I got a glass of water and a straw or two, and I headed back to the jail. So I gave this man a couple of those straws and held a glass up there to where he could get him a drink of water. This is something that I won't forget all my life. Just the way I saw that man in that jail.
Were there anything exciting? Had any hangings? Did they keep things pretty safe at that time?
You know, I can't just recall. I think they kept things pretty well in line.
Are there any kind of robberies that you can recall?
Well, not that I know of. An occasional bank robbery. That's about all.
No hangings or anything you say.
Mr. Unkin, thank you for your contribution to the South Texas Oral History and Folklore Collection.